McGraw-Hill Ascent Audio presents The Promise of Bitcoin, The Future of Money and How It Can Work for You by Bobby C. Lee, narrated by Bobby C. Lee. Publisher's note, in this audio edition, you will hear references to figures present in the print and ebook formats of the book. To my grandfather, William Sizen Lee, for always loving me and believing in me, you were the quintessential businessman. You gave me the confidence and inspiration to be an entrepreneur. Introduction: My Journey into Bitcoin. Until they become conscious, they will never rebel. And until after they've rebelled, they cannot become conscious. George Orwell, 1984. My name is Bobby Christopher Lee. The cryptocurrency community knows me as one of the industry's earliest entrepreneurs and investors in Bitcoin. I believe that any person or entity that interferes with productive individual or group enterprise is wrong. We've turned increasingly from principles of true liberty. We've allowed governments and other organizations that have mushroomed beyond their original intent to limit our activities. Even progressive nations restrict commerce via well-meaning but ill-conceived laws. They do not fathom entrepreneurship. For generations, my family, the Lees and Chus, built businesses and chased dreams with a singular focus that left little room for distraction or skeptics. Keep things simple and straight, and financial success will follow. Complicate issues, and you run into headwinds. Central banks are a primary source of economic mischief. They wield too much power and reflect the outdated thinking of a minority that has made holding their power their raison d'etre. At their core, these institutions perpetuate themselves rather than looking critically at what they should or should not do to help people. But wasn't helping people by creating a simple, comprehensive structure for managing currency why they were created? Alexander Hamilton understood this when he pushed for a U.S. central bank and currency that would be valued the same in every state. Instead, the banks became political instruments, divorced from their mission. They wield too much power and are too involved with people and their money. The bank's misjudgments intertwine with nearly every economic downturn of the past two centuries and have reduced the value and purchasing power of consumers' money. Once someone has earned money, no governing agency should have the right to take it without the individual's consent. Americans fought a revolution because the British overlords thought they could take the fruits of their industriousness at will. Do not confuse my thinking with current brands of extremism that see evil in the slightest institutional oversight. I appreciate the free trade agreements that have opened markets in recent years and will continue to do so whatever happens, post-NAFTA and Brexit. My family were successful international traders. The cryptocurrency business I helped found is global. So was every company that I worked for prior to becoming an entrepreneur. I appreciate having a passport that allows me to go pretty much anywhere in the world. And because I fly a lot, I'm grateful for the agencies that protect airports. I like owning real estate in different countries as it diversifies my investments. I also believe in smart regulations and products that protect our environment for future generations. I've been a gadget guy since I was a teen, and I've never experienced anything better than the Tesla Model 3 that I now drive. It can reach speeds up to 155 miles per hour and cover over 300 miles without a recharge. Silently, smoothly, with barely a carbon ripple. It is technology at its best, servicing a need, doing good without ruffling any government bureaucrat's feathers. To be sure, as a Stanford-trained computer scientist and software engineer, I'm biased about technology. I was exploring computer technology long before personal computers became part of the world's DNA. I taught myself computer programming in the sixth grade, beginning with the basic programming language. I started the personal computer club at my U.S. boarding school and majored in computer science at Stanford, a university at the heart of the global tech boom. During the summer of 1997, Bill Gates invited me to his home, albeit with several hundred other Microsoft summer interns. I've worked at some of the world's most important technology and internet companies, helped kickstart a major e-commerce initiative for the world's biggest retailer, and started my own cutting-edge tech business in China in 2013. It counted over 1 million users before I sold it in 2018. I am a forward thinker with strong opinions about what tech has done for the world, and even stronger beliefs about what it will do, particularly one remarkable innovation introduced by a developer who won't give his or her name, but who saw huge weaknesses in our monetary systems. Cryptocurrency, or as most people know it, Bitcoin. The pseudonymous Satoshi Nakamoto developed a new digital payment system that made brilliant use of disparate technological concepts. More importantly, it focused entirely on serving people worldwide, not controlling them. Digital cryptocurrency is one of the greatest inventions of the past half century. Satoshi's invention has consumed me for almost a quarter of my 46-year life. It has been a surprising journey that started with a conversation that wasn't the least bit momentous at the time. My brother, Charlie Lee, a computer scientist like me, had read about Bitcoin through online forums, and he had become interested enough to acquire his first Bitcoins through trading with anonymous people online. It was early 2011 when we had one of our occasional long-distance calls. I had been living in Shanghai for about 4 years and was about to join Walmart as a senior executive in charge of its technology team that was tasked with building a brand new e-commerce unit for the China market. Charlie was a Google engineer living in Silicon Valley. Mining, the process by which someone earns Bitcoin by recording a transaction on a digital ledger, was the domain of a few dedicated computer nerds who had enough computing power to solve the algorithms required for participation. There were no Bitcoin exchanges, Medium blogs, MIT blockchain programs, or intense discussions about regulations. Any banks that were aware of Bitcoin probably brushed away the topic like a speck of dust. To outsiders, Bitcoin was no more innovative than the latest in-game virtual currency in PC and console games, where people would use in-game currency to buy virtual swords or other weaponry. At the time, the spring of 2011, Bitcoin was selling for under $20 with a market capitalization of under $150 million. The community of enthusiasts and the curious numbered in the thousands globally. In the course of our discussion, Charlie suggested I check out this new electronic money called Bitcoin. As a computer geek, I had an advantage over the average consumer in understanding the concepts that Charlie outlined. I knew about online development, communities, and distributed networks, which are at the heart of the blockchain system. As much as it was a digital system, in the end, it relied on actual people with a deep passion. Because of my undergraduate and master's education at Stanford's prestigious computer science department, I had some training in cryptography. I also had a special interest in currencies, economics, and our monetary system. Charlie knew all that, and it was a thread that ran through our family for generations. My family's long journey. For at least a century, the Lee family on my father's side and the Chu family on my mother's side had been prolific entrepreneurs. They acquired success through a range of business ventures in Asia, South America, Africa, and finally North America. In the early decades of the 20th century, my paternal great-grandfather was the regional head of the Salt Administration of Jiangsu Province, which was the largest single source of the government's tax revenue at the time. It was a chaotic time as the Republic of China sorted out its governance after years of dynastic rule. The government relied on able administrators to maintain order and govern fairly in key industries. The Salt Administration was one of the most important ministries, so only the best qualified and most honest personalities were appointed to fill such posts. My paternal great-grandmother was a direct descendant of the imperial family from Manchuria that had ruled China for more than three centuries. She was a brilliant woman who spoke English fluently and earned a medical degree in a profession ruled by men at the time. She enjoyed this elite education because of her upbringing. However, once the dynasty fell, she and her relatives had to assume new family names to blend into the predominantly Han ethnic society. Manchurian family names were all long multisyllables, whereas the Han ethnic family names were all just one syllable. They all took the new surname of King, the traditional spelling of the Chinese character Jing, which means gold, and is now spelled as Jin in Chinese pinyin. Apparently, only descendants of the Manchurian imperial family could choose gold as their surname. In this turbulent time, the family also developed an appreciation for accumulating wealth and holding in what they viewed was the most widely accepted store of value, gold. It was a way to inoculate themselves against potential economic fluctuations in early 20th century Shanghai, which was as well known for corruption as commerce. My grandfather, William Sizen Lee, was born in Shanghai in 1925. Over the next quarter century, China experienced two pivotal events. First, the invasion by the Japanese, and second, the communist takeover following World War II. William, who had become a successful businessman by the time he was in his early 20s, feared an end to free enterprise. He had studied law at the prestigious Fudan University in Shanghai, so he had a good grasp of what was to come. In 1949, with Mao's forces controlling most of the country's vital operations, Citizen Lee used his clout to obtain 2 steamer tickets to Hong Kong. The year before, he had married Julia Ku, the daughter of a local cotton trader from Pudong, Shanghai. She was pregnant with their first child, my Uncle David. Because of their strong convictions about mainland China's future, they bought one-way tickets to Hong Kong, leaving the rest of their family behind. Once in Hong Kong, he took on his new Western name, William Lee. William and Julia became 2 of the 700,000 immigrants hoping to build a better future in the British colony, nearby but outside communist rule. But they recognized that even receptive democratic societies required capital to launch new ventures. They traveled with gold bars sewn into hidden pockets in their clothes. Gold was only $35 an ounce then, but it was a veritable fortune at a time when the U.S. government made news by doubling its minimum wage to 75 cents an hour, and a Hong Kong apartment rental cost the equivalent of $10 a month. Within a year, William had created an import-export business specializing in textiles, but the couple quickly recalculated in a way that only the entrepreneur and adventurous would consider. Alarmed by Hong Kong's population spike, they joined a small but determined group of expats who sought their fortunes not in industrialized economies with large Chinese populations, but rather in developing countries with cheap labor and production costs. They spent nearly 2 years in Brazil, saw a business or two fail, and then later moved to Sierra Leone, a small country in West Africa. As with many Chinese immigrants, their first business was a Chinese restaurant. A few more businesses and years later, they settled in the neighboring Ivory Coast, where William eventually founded a successful business manufacturing plastic sandals. At one point, he even dabbled in a business exporting shark fins to Hong Kong, where it was a well-loved delicacy. Unknown to them, my mother's parents, Lining Chu and Su Chen Pang, had followed a similar path about the same time. Lining Chu went to Hong Kong by himself in 1950 to build a pharmaceutical business. Soon after, he moved to Africa, where he built textile manufacturing businesses in Ghana and also opened enterprises in nearby Togo and Cameroon. He was among the first Chinese people doing business in Africa. The Chus faced an added obstacle in their odyssey to Africa. My mother and her 5 siblings had already been born in Shanghai, and the Chinese government was becoming increasingly restrictive about travel passes. Lining Chu sent for my grandmother, my uncle, and my mother soon after settling abroad. And over the course of the next decade, he diligently arranged exit visas for the remaining children, who had to stay back in Shanghai by themselves. The Chu and Li families didn't know each other, but they shared many of the same life principles. Both sides saw education, individual initiative, and hard work as keys to success. Both families insisted that their children, including my mother and father, attend good schools in Europe and the United States. My parents met while in college, married a few years later, and then returned to the Ivory Coast, where my father also entered the family business of manufacturing. I was born in 1975, the oldest of 3 siblings. When people ask me about my exotic birthplace, I tell them that I didn't have a choice. The Ivory Coast is where my parents were building their lives then. Charlie followed 2 years later, and my sister Vivian 4 years after that. For our upbringing, my parents followed roughly the same model they had grown up with. They enrolled us in the local American school through middle school and encouraged us to study hard. The Ivory Coast had a global feel in the 1980s, as it was the most cosmopolitan of all West African countries, mostly due to its strong French influence. I grew up learning 5 languages: English at the American International School I attended, French with Ivorian locals, and 3 dialects of Chinese at home. I spoke Shanghainese with my parents and grandparents, Chinese Mandarin with local Taiwanese expats, and Cantonese with our Hong Kong relatives and nanny. My father also believed in staying abreast of the latest tech developments and had a hunch about the potential of personal computers. He spent $10,000, a fortune in 1986, for an early Apple IIgs model, a 16-bit personal computer that generated huge buzz for its multimedia color graphics and sound, but seems medieval by today's standards. The Apple IIgs spurred my interest in computers. I marveled at its full-color display, crisp responses to typed message commands, and overall versatility. By 7th grade, Charlie and I were already teaching ourselves coding and gobbling up anything we could find on computer programming, which was minimal. Our favorites were the early personal computer magazines, which had source code listings for sample games, where we could follow along, type in, and run our own programs. In many cases, I would politely ask Charlie to type in those long lines of computer programming from the magazine listings. He was nice about it and didn't complain. My father nurtured our interest in computers via product upgrades and game purchases. We were always the first family in the neighborhood with the latest Apple computer software and hardware peripherals. When I started at Lawrenceville in 1989, I was already using a laptop computer made by Sharp. At 20 pounds, it was heavier than the largest toaster and almost as clunky, but it was also a revelation to my classmates who were just learning about the revolution to come. I could set up anywhere, and the device had an early LCD screen, which made for crisper fonts. It was like looking into the future, albeit through an 8-bit flickering grayscale display. From then on, I was hooked on computers and technology. Off to Stanford. My father, the MIT alum, expected me to follow his lead, but I chose Stanford instead. 25 years earlier, Stanford had been among the first to create a department offering computer science degrees. Its early researchers invented the PDP-1-based timesharing system, the world's first display-oriented timesharing system, and the DEC PDP-6 program, an operating system that is the grandfather to today's Windows and Mac OS. Its faculty included Turing Award winners and pioneers in computer science, robotics, automation, and artificial intelligence. Some Stanford students, I soon also learned, were as passionate about computers as I was and equally entrepreneurial. Many of them shared my experience as outliers entering uncharted territories looking for creative ways to apply the binary numbers of coding to products that could transform personal interaction and enterprise. The school had a sizable computer lab with the latest computer workstations and encouraged students to explore and invent, and I started reading snippets about a growing industry called venture capital-backed startups. In 1998, I eagerly applied for and I got accepted into Stanford's entrepreneurship class, the Mayfield Fellows Program. The tie-in between finance, tech, and entrepreneurship was already intriguing for me. I had been president of Lawrenceville's Wall Street Club, which conducted mock trading and won the annual competition for most successful portfolio. My picks included a little-known Omaha, Nebraska-based investment company, Berkshire Hathaway, and gold mining stocks. My father was my secret stock advisor for this mock trading game, and we had many long-distance phone calls discussing which stocks to invest in and why. Although I didn't know this at the time, as I enjoyed my freshman year at Stanford University, Jerry Yang and David Filo had already developed the framework for Yahoo, which would launch a year later, and for whom I would work for more than a half decade. Google founders Sergey Brin and Larry Page had begun working towards their doctorate, Brin on a graduate fellowship from the National Science Foundation. I had found my tribe. My introduction to Bitcoin. Fast forward to 2011, just 13 years after graduating Stanford with a bachelor's and master's degrees in computer science. Through these memorable years, I had scored internships at Microsoft, where I introduced myself to Bill Gates at the annual interns barbecue he held each summer, and at IBM, the aging lion of the modern computer industry. I had held management positions at Yahoo and other American and Chinese technology companies, and was now about to start work on my biggest role yet. I was one of the 5 vice presidents managing a new e-commerce service in China for Walmart, the world's largest company by revenue. Walmart figured it could challenge Chinese online retail powerhouses Taobao and Jingdong in the world's most populated country. Walmart called its effort Project Panda. But it quickly became apparent that Project Panda faced an uphill struggle as much because of internal politics as outside competition. Walmart was quick to hedge its bet by investing in an established Chinese e-commerce company, Yihaodian, and pitted our newly formed division against them. We had no chance. My 150-member technology team did yeoman's work but couldn't catch up to our established in-house competitor. Within a year, we could all see the end game for Project Panda. During that year, I had my first conversation about Bitcoin with my brother. Charlie had graduated from MIT's 5-year master's program in electrical engineering and computer science and was working as a software engineer on Google's Chrome OS team. Charlie outlined how Bitcoin worked and how it had built a small global following in its 2 years of existence. More importantly, Charlie made a compelling case for Satoshi's Bitcoin thesis and its potential for revolutionizing finance. I was hooked. Just as I started my promising Walmart career, I mined my first Bitcoins. The experience was addictive, and I started looking for graphics cards that would accelerate my computer's ability to solve the algorithmic problems that would reward me with more Bitcoins. The global Bitcoin community was tiny, but I suspect there was at least one other hobbyist in Shanghai who always seemed to be one step ahead of me. Apparently, he bought out the local computer store's supply of high-end graphics cards. The shelves were empty at every store I visited. Thankfully, I found supplies overseas. I mined Bitcoin from the summer through fall of 2011. My single mining rig ran all day, every day, and it was enough to heat up the whole empty guest room in my apartment in downtown Shanghai. In late 2012, shortly after leaving Walmart, I decided to take an early exit off the traditional technology management career path and make Bitcoin my full-time career. It was a bold step into an uncharted field. The possibilities were enormous, but the truth was I wasn't sure exactly what I would do. Mining didn't offer enough variety. Once you knew what you were doing, it wasn't mentally stimulating. But Bitcoin was just about to catch the public eye. What would consumers need to quicken the pace? I had bought additional Bitcoins on a local exchange website called btcchina.com, created by two Chinese men in their late 20s, one a computer programmer from Nanjing and the other a businessman from Beijing. A switch turned on inside me. This was in the days before Litecoin, Ethereum, and all of the other cryptocurrencies had launched. The idea behind BTC China was inspired, and it compelled me to act. Here was an easy-to-use Bitcoin exchange platform available to everyone in China. Its functions needed work, but that's where I could apply my years of experience building consumer-facing platforms. I emailed them cold, asking via customer support to see if I could speak with the boss. A week later, I was in Beijing outlining my BTC China vision over a Peking duck dinner. And when the three of us had closed the restaurant, we continued at a coffee shop late into the night. Our backgrounds were complementary and our passion and vision were aligned. We would make a good team. They were skilled entrepreneurs who had a sound foundation, but they lacked managerial know-how, vision, and a sense of how to find funding to energize a business. I could bring big-picture corporate expertise to the mix and an understanding of how technology startups thrive. I also knew about the bumps of early-stage companies. Like startups in most new industries, BTC China might see huge spikes and then lulls of activity. Over the ensuing weeks, I purchased shares in the company, took on the title of co-founder and CEO, and immediately began speaking with venture capitalists to raise money. When we closed the deal on my role in early 2013, Bitcoin's price was just under $15. About this time, Bitcoin prices and trading volumes started climbing. We were using my Shanghai apartment as our headquarters. But after recruiting two customer service representatives and an ex-Walmart colleague, we leased our first office, a 2,000 square feet open floor plan in the Xujiahui neighborhood, not far from Shanghai's business epicenter. It was a small office on the 23rd floor of an office building with brightly colored walls painted by the previous tenant, an internet content delivery network company. We were excited to get started and to build a real Bitcoin company in China. By then, I had also secured a $5 million investment round led by venture firm Lightspeed China, an offshoot of the famed Menlo Park, California venture firm by the same name. Lightspeed China counted some of the country's highest profile tech companies in its portfolio. We were the first cryptocurrency company in all of Asia to receive venture funding. We adopted best practices that were drawn from the American startup world, but were new to China's emerging economy. We provided free sodas and drinks at the office, handed out t-shirts and other gear with our corporate logo, and took employees to the movies to foster team building. I borrowed several traditions from Yahoo, including one where we gave employees custom-designed coffee mugs each Christmas. Employees collected a different personalized mug for every year of service. The hours were long. We even made Saturday a regular workday. On a memorable company retreat in the fall of 2013, at a vacation island outside Shanghai, we spent most of the time in conference rooms revamping our platform to accommodate a sudden jolt in trading volumes. Bitcoin had just passed $200. But BTC China also ran a lean ship. We stayed put in our small space even as we quadrupled our workforce. We mapped product designs and engineering solutions on the glass walls enclosing the conference rooms, which served as a makeshift whiteboards. We felt we were part of a bold mission, the introduction of a new type of decentralized digital asset based on a technology with huge potential called blockchain. We focused everything we did on building our business into something that the average consumer and investor could recognize. Exiting BTC China. The ride was often challenging. For every new customer, we heard from dozens of naysayers. What is this new currency? How can it be valuable? Why would anyone use it? Does it have the government's support? Who's regulating it? Isn't it more vulnerable to hacking than an online bank account? Then there were the shocks. After shooting over $1,100 by late 2013, Bitcoin quickly lost two-thirds of its value, stoking fears that it was no better than play money. Meanwhile, two aggressive, well-supported competitors emerged, OKCoin and Huobi. They reduced the trading fees, so we started a price war by cutting trading commissions to zero. That was good for customers, but drained our cash reserves. We cut staff, introduced new trading features and other new services to boost sales, and we went out to seek a fresh cash infusion. A small surge in Bitcoin prices and the subsequent demand for exchange services near the end of 2015 helped push us into cash positive territory. We were finally profitable. The next obstacle arose 2 years later when the Chinese government started cracking down on crypto trading and initial coin offers, a mechanism for funding blockchain projects, largely because these were activities that regulators could not control. In September 2017, we shuttered the domestic BTC China exchange for trading. At the time, we boasted over 1 million registered users, a staff of 150, and four separate offices. We kept open our international business called BTCC, based in our Hong Kong office. In January 2018, we sold our business to a Hong Kong-based blockchain investment fund. The acquisition came when the price of Bitcoin was hovering over $10,000, down from the much-ballyhooed high of $20,000 a month earlier, but more than a hundredfold higher than the price when BTC China opened for business. Bitcoin was fulfilling Satoshi Nakamoto's vision that a digital currency open to anyone, controlled by no one, would find a wide following. In his 2008 paper, Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system, Satoshi had outlined a system that would allow individual parties to execute financial transactions without the participation of an intermediary controlling entity. These controlling entities, or centralized organizations, most prominently banks, credit card companies, or increasingly electronic payment services like PayPal, had traditionally filled an accounting role, ensuring the accuracy of every activity. Although bank loans and deposits have roots before the birth of Christ, the system upon which the modern banking model bases itself dates to the Medici family in the Italian Renaissance. The Medici recognized an ongoing need among the powerful elite for well-organized financial management services on a large scale via one powerful entity. Over the centuries, the public came to trust these centralized organizations as the most secure place to park their hard-earned cash. Banks ranked among society's most respected organizations. They were too big to fail. Or were they? Just 3 months after the economic crash of 2008, when several large financial institutions failed, Satoshi's 9-page paper offered a more streamlined, efficient alternative to the traditional system. Satoshi had recognized the greatest flaw in the traditional model, namely that the centralized organizations controlled every activity within their networks. They could delay, stop, and even reverse transactions that they determined had not met their standards. Fairness and objectivity often did not guide their decisions. Moreover, the cost of their mediation services increased transaction costs, and perversely, the banks were financially incentivized more and more for their involvement in these financial transactions. The system works well enough, Satoshi wrote, but upon closer inspection, it also created obstacles to which most consumers had grown immune, such as transaction costs and lack of control. His electronic payment system removed the impediments, allowing two willing parties to transact directly, to move payments from one digital account to another with access based on memorizing a key of binary numbers. He described the coins as a chain of digital signatures, or bitcoins. The now widely used term refers to bits, the zeros and ones that are the smallest units of data in computer language. A network of computer-savvy participants, miners, use their computation power to ensure the integrity of this new currency system by verifying and recording each transaction on a digital ledger open for public review. Each time-stamped transaction, approved by a consensus of miners, would become a part of a chain of data blocks called the blockchain. To falsify a transaction would require altering earlier entries, alerting the group and invalidating the record and all subsequent ones.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?